tonight's talk is a continuation of this series. I just want to briefly go over what we've covered up until now. Really, we talked about the first three of the Four Noble Truths. You know, the inevitability, I suppose, of the fact that things are unsatisfactory, and that dukkha is. It's just and something we have to take in and really understand. And then the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, which was tanha, grasping, craving, clinging, and all the different ways we can get caught doing that. And then the third noble truth was actually quite similar. It just said, if you want to stop suffering, just stop grasping. Quite simple. And then we talked, what that actually meant. What does it mean? What would it be like to stop grasping? Now, if the Buddha had stopped here, if the Buddha had stopped with just the first three noble truths, he would probably have be thought of as a philosopher. But then he actually added the fourth noble truth, which was, and now, here's how you can do that. Here's the clear set of instructions on how we can actually stop grasping, how we can actually stop clinging. Without that, without the instructions, this is philosophy. With the instructions, this is practical life advice. Takes on a very different coloring when you look at the fourth noble truth and how it very clearly lays out these steps. You know, they call it the Noble Eightfold Path, right? And so tonight what I want to look at is the first two of these eight steps on the Eightfold Path. I also want to note that steps implies, in a sense, progression. And I have to say, yes, but. It's like, yes, there is sort of a progression. You can see how one thing leads to another. But it's like, in a sense, all of these things have to be active all the time. And, you know, we maybe put more emphasis on one than another at a certain time in our life or a certain time in our practice. And then we might come back 5 years later and go, oh, now, and you'll see more deeply what these first two, what are called the wisdom factors, really mean. So something you're never finished. You never stop looking at these things. These things are all practices. Practices implies that there's something we actually have to do. It isn't just some intellectual thing that we think about. It's an actual practice that we have to focus on. So the first two, like I said, are what are called the wisdom factors. And the wisdom factors are, first one is sometimes called right understanding or right view. I prefer the word skillful or something that, I don't like the word right. So though right is, you hear me saying right because it's so common in the actual translations. But I don't particularly like the word right because it implies sort of right and wrong and sort of a wagging finger or something like that. So I like, we'll stick with skillful for now. And in the sutta, the Buddha talks about right view from two different points of view. And I want to actually just read from the sutta. This is from a sutta called the Great 40. And it's quite an interesting sutta because the Buddha goes into very great detail about all of these steps on the Eightfold Path, you know, with a slightly different emphasis sometimes from other suttas I've seen. So, and he starts very, very precisely. He says, therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. Well, yeah, interesting way to say things. Well, if it's right view, if you have right view, right? But then luckily he goes on to explain in a lot more detail. And what bhikkhus is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There's right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening and acquisitions. That means right view in the world, in our lives, in our daily interaction with things. And there's right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. So this is this dichotomy that occurs over and over again in the Buddhist teachings, where there's basically two worlds we live in simultaneously. The relative world, the day-to-day world, the world where we're interacting with things and people and our mind is functioning in its daily, somewhat confused manner sometimes, perhaps. And then there's the absolute view or absolute reality, which is, as he says, taintless and supramundane. And what he's saying is that right view can have either of these aspects. And then he goes on to say, and what bhikkhus is right view that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in its acquisitions. There's what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There's fruit and the results of good and bad actions. There's the world, this world and the other world. There's mother and father. There are beings who are born spontaneously. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is right view affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. What the heck does all that mean? he's got a list of several things here, right? And the first of these is, he says here, there's what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. He's talking about generosity. He's talking about the fact that part of having right understanding is to understand the importance of generosity in our lives. The fact that whenever the Buddha taught, the very first thing he always taught when he went to a new place is he taught about generosity, about dana. And he talked about it in a way that how important it is to give freely, because giving freely gladdens the heart. It opens the heart up to the outside, to others. And how central that is to understanding. The understanding is basically that we're not alone in the world, we're not separate, we're not just here to grab what we can, we're here to connect with others and share with others. And that's sort of the very beginnings of what it's, you know, this mundane right view in the world. And then he comes to the results of good and bad actions and understanding the laws of karma and reincarnation. I'm not going to go very deeply into this, but we need to understand, part of understanding is that every action we take of body and speech has consequences. And these consequences shape our lives, both right now and in the future. And I want to really stress that I don't in any way suggest you should just blindly accept the ideas of reincarnation as a dogma that you have to believe in. Joseph Goldstein has this really great thing he says all the time about this and about some other topics as well. He says, you don't have to believe, you just have to try and suspend disbelief. which is different than believing, right? Just suspend disbelief. Just leave this as an open question. And as you go along in your practice over time, in my own experience, you come to sort of an understanding of these teachings on karma and reincarnation in a way that you can't be explained, but it just becomes like, well, yeah, of course. It's like becomes obvious that that's what's happening. That's what's going on. That's the underlying truth of our existence, in a sense. Then he says something else. I think the next thing on the list is, there is mother and father. And what are they doing here? How did mother and father all of a sudden get into these teachings? And what he's saying here, what he's trying to emphasize, is that we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have these bodies and minds that can practice if it hadn't been for our mother and father. And I want to be careful here, because I know some people have very delicate, sometimes difficult, sometimes extremely difficult relationships with parents. So I'm not going to in any way suggest that, you know, you should love them or anything like that. But we have to, what he's saying here is like, acknowledge the fact that you have to have gratitude just for the fact that you have this body, that you're here in this world because you had a mother and a father, that you owe them gratitude for that, if nothing else. Difficult as that might be sometimes for us to deal with because of other things to do with the relationship. And part of that gratitude might be, note the word might here, very careful, might be that you share what you're understanding with them. Share your right understanding with your parents as a way to express your gratitude. For some parents, of course, this would be not a good idea. Might even be a very difficult and touchy subject to even go towards. But that's okay. And I suppose I want to expand this to be not just parents, but relatives, close friends, all those sort of people that, you know, we get excited about this stuff. We go, oh, this Dharma stuff is just so great. Everybody should understand this to know all about it. And you have to be very careful. We want to share it. We want to spread the joy, spread the good stuff, right? But we have to be very careful not to fall into that energy of being a proselytizer. It's like, this will change your life and everybody should know all about this. This is the right way, blah, blah, blah. We don't want to go there. And often the best thing you can do is that you actually just live out the teachings. And in living out the teachings, just doing that, people notice, oh, look, you know, whoever that is, whatever your name is, there's something different about this person. And they tune into it, tune into the energy of this practice in your life and become curious. And then they might ask a few questions, and then without preaching or proselytizing, just say, oh, well, you know, this is what I'm doing in here. Maybe you might want to read this interesting book I came across, or go listen to this talk on this website or whatever. And it's a way of expressing gratitude to parents and family in a simple way. More so, it's more like just being, I'm this, maybe sometimes, especially in difficult family situations, you're the calm person in the room, which would be a very huge gift in a lot of difficult family situations sometimes. Just being that calm person in the room. And then in this sutta, then he says one other thing. He says, understand that there are beings in the world right now who are enlightened. Which is When you think about it, quite a statement that right now in this world, there are beings that are enlightened. And we can't forget that either. I want to read something that Joseph Goldstein says about this. This is a, he's talking as a Westerner, in fact, as an American. And so this has actually quite an interesting flavor to it in some senses. Joseph is very practical. Our egalitarian values can sometimes diminish the understanding that there are actually people wiser than ourselves, people from whom we can genuinely learn about the Dharma, the truth, the way things are. Acknowledging this can help us open to wisdom from unexpected sources. We learn to listen for that voice of genuine experience rather than being influenced positively or negatively by personality or position. Recognizing that there are genuinely wise and awakened beings in the world helps us to reaffirm the understanding that wisdom and awakening are possible for us as well. Very important. We all have this capability. You can practice applying various aspects of mundane right view in different ways. Some may be obvious to us, like the practice of generosity, which bears wholesome fruit, or investigating our motivations and acting on the wholesome and letting go of the unwholesome. Other aspects of this right view may not be immediately apparent. The key part of that sentence that I just read is that right view is a practice. It isn't like, oh, I got this all figured out. I don't have to think about this anymore. Every time we're considering something, every time we're, you know, making a choice in the world, especially more important choices, perhaps, we have to go, how does this fit with the Buddha's teachings? How does this fit? Is this based on right view? Is this based on me actually understanding, or is this based on desire, on wanting? And so it's like right view becomes a daily practice. It starts to be the compass that steers us through life in the mundane world. Okay, so that's the first part of this right understanding of right view. Then the Buddha goes on. He wants to talk about this other one, what he called right view without taints, or super mundane view, or what was it? He used another word here too, taintless, right? And what because is right view that is noble, taintless, super mundane, a factor of the path? The wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the investigation of states, enlightenment factor, the path factor of right view is one whose whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. That is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, and a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. That is one's effort. Mindfully, one abandons wrong view. Mindfully, one enters upon and abides in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right view. That is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. So this is how he's already starting to integrate two other steps in the Eightfold Path, right effort and right view and right mindfulness, and saying how they influence our view, this one we'll call the super mundane view. And it's like, oh yeah, this is like, that's why this is these things are our practice. This isn't just something, you know, we can casually think about and decide, yeah, I got this and let it go. It's something that we, as I said earlier, it's something we have to practice, that they're intertwined so tightly. So I want to go back to Joseph Goldstein here again. So he's talking about this noble right view. Noble right view is described in terms of its objective content. That is what wisdom discovers as it illuminates our experience. In the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha equates this liberating right view specifically to the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And what monks is right view? It is monks, the knowledge of dukkha, the knowledge of the origin of dukkha, the knowledge of the cessation of dukkha, the knowledge of the way of practicing leading to the cessation of dukkha. This is called right view. The Buddha is so clear about emphasizing the importance of right view in promoting the welfare of beings. Bhikkhus, I do not see even a single thing on account of which unarisen wholesome qualities arise and arisen wholesome qualities increase and expand so much as right view. Mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths is in fact the last set of instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddhist instructions on meditation. So what he's saying, what the Buddha is saying and what Joseph is repeating is that this idea that we actually have to understand the first three noble truths and have a very clear understanding of how they, what they mean in our lives. That's right view. If we can really truly understand them at some beyond the intellectual level, at some deeper visceral level, then right view naturally arises. Right view arises directly out of that understanding. The source of right view is our understanding of the first three noble truths and our acceptance of the fact that there's a fourth, which is the path. And when we understand these things, when we actually understand the first three noble truths, then we understand that there's nothing else that's more important than practice. That there's no other goal, you know, no other reason for doing anything other than actually working towards enlightenment. That's what the Buddha is saying. It's like he makes it very clear. This is what, you know, if there's any reason why we're here, why we have these bodies and minds, this is the reason we have these bodies and minds. There's another piece of this I want to talk about a little bit. And that's, because I've already mentioned this a little bit, the idea that right view is a practice. There is, you know, we use the word mindfulness a lot. Mindfulness is a particular translation of the Pali word sati. Sati, you know, from the Satipatthana Sutta, the mindfulness wisdom teachings. But sati actually is one of those Pali words that has a lot of different flavors of meaning. And mindfulness is, you know, a good one, but there are others. And one that I really like and have been coming back to more and more is remembering. Sati means remembering. And what are we supposed to be remembering? We're supposed to be remembering right view. We're supposed to be remembering how we have to apply those teachings to our lives. That we can't somehow have this sort of philosophical concept separate somehow from our daily life and our daily practice. That they have to be sort of tightly integrated, and they have to be something we keep remembering. You know, we're about to make a decision. How does right view affect this decision? So, and it's that word remembering that I think if we're going to make this into a practice, that's what we have to do more than anything else, just remember. Remember to keep doing it again and again. Keep coming back to this idea of right view. Okay, and then, so that's the first of the steps. The second of the two is right intention, or sometimes called right thought. Here I really like the word wholesome, and as opposed to right, wholesome intention. Seems to has the right flavor for me. And I want to talk very quickly about intention itself. I mean, the intention is a mental factor, you know, and there's this huge long list in the Abhidhamma of different mental factors that were very carefully enumerated. I think there's like 52 mental factors, right, by various things. And one of the primary ones, one that we're dealing with all the time, is intention. Before we do anything, any act of body, speech, or mind must be preceded by intention. If I want to, you know, wave to you, I had to have the intention to lift my arm and shake it back and forth. If I hadn't, if that mental factor of intention wasn't there, that would not have happened. So intention pervades everything we do all the time. It's always active, becoming the force, in a sense, that makes things happen in our world. So then we have to think, well, what does, if that's true, well, I better be careful with my intentions, might be one thing I think. But what do I mean by wholesome intention? And I want to actually tell there's a famous story about intention. And this is a story of this bandit king, I suppose, called Angulimala. This is from the sutta again. And Angulimala was a notorious bandit and murderer. And Anguli means finger, and mala means necklace. And he was known as Angulimala because every time he killed somebody, he would chop off one of their fingers and put it on his necklace. And it must have been a pretty big necklace because he had, at this point in the story, 999 fingers on his necklace. And he decided, because he'd heard about this guy, this Buddha guy, that, boy, that would make the great, like just the best number 1,000 finger for my necklace. The Buddha, as he was known, was wandering, as he did often, just going from place to place. And he was coming, about to go down this trail, and the local village said, oh, don't go down that trail. You know, Angulimala hangs out in that forest, and you go down that trail, you'll be in trouble. You'll meet Angulimala. And Buddha said, yeah, it's okay. Just ignored them, basically, and kept on going. And then, so there he is, just sort of walking along. You can sort of imagine how calm and peaceful he's walking. And Angulimala sees it. Oh, it's him. It's the Gautama. It's that guy whose finger I want so bad. And he starts to run after the Buddha. And the Buddha just keeps walking along and walking along. And Angulimala keeps running faster and faster and faster. But no matter how fast he runs, he can't catch up to the Buddha. The Buddha is just walking along, and Angulimala is chasing him and can't catch him. And finally, he says, "Stop! Stop! I gotta explain to me what's going on here. How come I can't catch you?" And the Buddha teaches him the Dhamma. And right on the spot, this guy who is notorious for murdering people and robbing people, and the Buddha taught him the Dhamma, and he took vows right on the spot, Angulimala, and became one of the Buddha's disciples. Which caused difficulty later on, actually, as the story goes, because now he's a disciple of the Buddha, so nobody can harm him. Nobody can bother him. You can't strike a monk or, you know, do that sort of thing. But people were really angry because he murdered 999 people, right? He had a lot of people who were really unhappy with him. And so the story goes, he would go an alms round, and the people couldn't harm him or hit him, but they'd put dung in his alms bowl or something rotten in his, you know. They would do things that, you know, and he would complain to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, well, you know, you have to live out the results of your actions here. You know? And eventually, as the story goes, Angulimala became enlightened. He was, to be that good at anything, even murdering people, you have to have a very precise, concentrated mind. And so he already had that. He just had to redirect it in more skillful ways. And sure enough, he did, according to the sutta anyway. So the reason I wanted to mention this is there's an example of unwholesome intention, right? Let's murder the Buddha and cut off his finger. And transformed into wholesome intention, where he took vows and actually practiced and became enlightened despite all the harassment he took from people. So what makes up wholesome intention? What are the main factors? And basically, the main thing I want to get across tonight is that we can cultivate wholesome intention by cultivating renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. Three wholesome factors. And the first of these is renunciation. And to be honest with you, I'm always nervous when I say that word in a Dharma talk, because people hear renunciation and they sort of flinch a little bit, like, ooh, you mean I gotta, you know, give something up? I have to renounce something? And also, if you follow the Dharma news at all in the world, a large number of renunciants, so to speak, have been exposed over the last 30 or 40 years or 50 years or however long it's been going on, who've been, shall we say, somewhat less than renunciate, who have acted very poorly in the world. And so it has that sort of flavor, that whole idea of renouncing. But the Buddha is very, very forceful when he talks about this. He says, that's how you have to start. You have to start by looking at, even in the, and you know, you don't need to become a monk and become a full renunciate and give up the world and have nothing but a bowl and a cloth. But you need to look at go, what can I give up in my life? What can I do without now? Whether it's something small or something bigger or whatever, some combination of things. But what can I do that creates this space around my life where I have more time for practice? That's what renunciation for us householders means. How can I shift my life, which is, if your life's like anybody else's life in our culture, busy, how can I look at and go, okay, now I have to let that go so I have more time for this. I have more time for practice. I have more time to look deeper. This goes against our very nature, because we the whole culture basically says, no, if you want to have a good life, you want to seek things that are pleasurable and avoid things that are unpleasurable. Yeah, you want to own all this good stuff. You don't want to do anything that's going to be unpleasant, which is the opposite of renunciation, essentially. And that's, but it's deeply ingrained in our habitual patterns of thought and action in the world. And so we have to look at those patterns and go, oh, do I really need to X? And it might just be, you know, I want to spend half an hour meditating every morning. That means I maybe don't spend so much time, speaking in my case, reading the New York Times. I'm a big New York Times fan. And I just have to make sure I don't get caught up in the New York Times, and then I don't practice. I'm reading all those amazing things. And I mean, New York Times is amazing. It's got stuff about everything. Or whatever. I have to sort of look at what I do and shift my time allotment so that I have more time to practice. Less time for other things. So that's on day-to-day life. Also, it might mean, you know, we all in our culture are, you know, we go on vacations. And maybe we have to start going, oh, instead of going to the beach or going hiking in the mountains for a week or whatever it is we would do on a vacation, we'll go on retreat for a week. That's true renunciation. That's really renouncing our comfortable daily lives or our vacation time. Oh my God, to give up our vacation time, what a radical thing to do. But that's how we have to start thinking. How can I shift my life to put practice first? That's what renunciation means. That's what it's all about. And though it seems almost like, oh, that'll not be so great. When you really start practicing intentionally more, it feels, and this is, I'm speaking from personal experience here, it feels great. It's wonderful. It really uplifts your life and shifts your life in ways that nothing else I can imagine that did. And I tried a lot of different things in my youth to see if I make myself feel better. Practice is the only thing that's ever really made a huge difference and a permanent difference. And it's just like choosing to do that instead of other things. There was a time in my life where I, for about 10 or 12 years, I went for a retreat for a month to 6 weeks every year without fail. That's something I had to do. I haven't done that in the last couple of years, but it's like, it was really important that's my practice became what was important. So that's renunciation. And I want to read another thing from Joseph here. The question for us is how to put this step on the path into practice. In one discourse of the middle length discourses called the Two Kinds of Thoughts, the Buddha suggests one way to begin. Cultivate a clear discernment of the kinds of thoughts that arise in our mind. So this is these are meditation instructions, okay? Cultivate a clear discernment of the kinds of thoughts that arise in our minds. We can notice which thoughts are rooted in desire, ill will, or cruelty. Consciously reflect on the karma that they cause and then abandon them, letting them go. And we can notice those thoughts inclining towards renunciation, goodwill, and compassion, reflect on their value, and then strengthen them in our lives. All of this is wise reflection in the service of the path. As we become more mindful of these two classes of thoughts, we also become more aware of the strength and seductive powers of the unwholesome patterns. Ill will and aversion are said to be more dangerous than greed and desire, but easier to uproot, whereas desire is less dangerous but harder to uproot. Interesting, huh? Why is this? Ill will has more harmful consequences, but it is also unpleasant, and the suffering of it is obvious. Some sense desire, on the other hand, are usually associated with pleasure, and not always apparent why renouncing them is a good idea. So that's like practice advice, in a sense. What can we do? We can, and he's actually saying, at a certain point in mindfulness practice, we're starting to see, and I think I mentioned this, sort of being a recurring theme for me lately. Our practice becomes less about the actual content of what's arising in our mind as seeing the underlying patterns of what's arising in our mind. Because that's what leads us to see what's actually happening and then form the intention, the wholesome, the skillful intention to shift those patterns. Because we start to see how those patterns arise over and over and over and over. And so So the other, as I said, we want to cultivate renunciation. And then we want to also cultivate loving kindness and compassion. This is like so practical. We start living for others more and less for ourselves. We're consciously choosing a life filled with loving kindness and compassion. We're seeing more how we're all interconnected. We're seeing how I act in the world affects the world. It affects everyone around me. And if I can literally cultivate loving kindness and compassion, metta and karuna, then it changes how I affect the world, changes my heart. Most important, changes my heart. And that's what leads us further on the path. It's literally just having loving kindness for others, having compassion for others, leads us towards having a better life. It's really that simple. I mean, I can't put it any other way than that. It's once again speaking from personal experience, and both of these, particularly loving kindness in the Theravada tradition that I'm part of, is something you can practice. There's a whole set of practices around practicing loving kindness, metta practice, that are very powerful practices that you can make part of your daily practice. Or in my case, I shift back and forth. I'll go through periods where my practice is more just mindfulness and periods when my practice is more metta, or exclusively metta sometimes for months at a time. But the thing about loving kindness is it's also something we can practice very easily in our daily lives. We just look around as we're sort of going through our lives, and if we're mindful, we keep seeing opportunities to express loving kindness towards others over and over and over again. If we're just looking, we'll see. And it could be as simple as there you are getting in line, like we all do these days. I was getting in line in the store today to go get into a cashier, and of course it's a line, and someone else was coming right there too, and I just paused and said, why don't you go first? And it, you know, so maybe I spent an extra 30 seconds in the store, but it was a simple act of loving kindness. Something I could just do. And it's just sometimes little things like that just the tiniest little things sometimes that make it made me happy to be able to do that. I'll be honest with you, it felt good. It made this other person happy. You know, if this person was actually sort of kind and let me go in front, maybe they're in a hurry, who knows? It's just little things, but it's something that we have to be mindful and see these opportunities in our daily life to express loving kindness and express compassion in the world. That is also, so that can become our intention. Remember, everything starts from intention. And if we have the intention to shift our lives towards more renunciation, more loving kindness, more compassion, then that will deepen our practice, just like that. These two come first in a sense, you know, the right view and right intention, because they sort of form the foundation for the rest of the practice. But at the same time, and this is, I mentioned this earlier, it's become very clear to me that I keep coming back around to these two and going, oh, that's something I never saw. I never saw it quite that way before. Even you see, start to go see it more deeply. As you deepen your practice, your understanding of these things becomes deeper as well. And it's that's why I keep coming back to the idea that these are practices. It's like, if we can remember, there's that mindfulness, that remembering. If we can remember to keep forming this right intention, this wholesome intention, then things flow better. It's smoother. It creates more happiness in the world, which is something I think we can all do for the world. And I think the world certainly these days needs a lot more happiness. So if we can all help create a little more happiness, so much the better, as far as I'm concerned. And it also sort of acknowledges, especially loving kindness and compassion, how interconnected we are. And certainly these days, my understanding of how interconnected we are because of what's going on in the world all around us. It keeps overwhelming me almost, like, oh my God, look how tied together we are without even knowing it. Look how interconnected we all are. And so in a sense, you know, despite how the huge problems this pandemic is causing us all, it also is an opportunity to learn. To say, oh, look at that. Look how much we're connected as opposed to separate. Might be something we all can learn from what's happening around us every day. That wouldn't be a bad thing as far as I'm concerned. It would be a very good thing, as a matter of fact. I want to finish, as I always do, with a poem. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, which I often read from. Which, in a sense, reflects what I was just saying. It's a poem called, Surely This Is Love. I am intimately connected with all that is. When you water your roots, my heart blossoms. When I see you smile, that's when I know I'm fully alive. As you are able to live in truth, I raise the roof on this house I am exploring. I throw the doors wide, let the breeze blow in the windows. When you grow, I know it as my own opening. You stretch, I breathe. I give and you receive. Just beneath the fabric of our lives, coiled ready to spring or budding like a rose, reaching out to embrace or sitting, bathed in grace and stillness, this singing, circling, radiant, one with everything. Surely, this is love. So that's all I have to say. I have to, yeah, yeah.